20. What Rukyak told Sprout might well be true. Our initial analyses told us that the Descolada code they sent us at first had only trivial differences to the virus we've known for so long.
Well, that was foolish of us to think that any differences were trivial.
I think so. But we all agreed to that error until Sprout told us that here the Descolada did not behave as a destructive disease.
I assume you found the points of difference.
2, in fact. And each of those genes is off by 1 broken molecule, in our version.
You're saying that their copy is the original and ours is defective?
I've run functional simulations based on your earlier studies of how the Descolada progressed in our cells. The nest version enters the nucleus and splits the entire genome, connecting it to a neutral protein strand that prevents the genes from being active in any way. It's a complete record of that creature's genome.
The recorder virus.
Then the simulation shows the nest version of the Descolada, with the captured genome, leaving the nucleus and the cell, and then eventually leaving the body. It does not propagate inside the original host, because this switch here keeps it from activating the replication sequence inside the host body.
But in our Descolada, the anti-replication switch is broken.
And so the Descolada does replicate, eventually taking every cell in the body, tearing apart its DNA, and then using the nucleus to create new copies of itself.
And the other broken gene?
The simulation doesn't know what to do with it. So I thought, what does the recorder virus do that our Descolada never did?
Record?
That's why you're head of this project, dear sister. When I studied the nest recorder virus, that other gene seems to be the switch to create the neutral strands that the host DNA attaches to.
Everything that the recorder virus does that is useful, our version doesn't do. And everything ours does that is most dangerous, theirs doesn't do.
Without clinical trials, which would be unethical to attempt, we can't be sure. But it makes sense. My question is, was the breaking of those genes deliberate in order to weaponize the Descolada? Or could these two occur by collisions with cosmic radiation during the passage from planet to planet?
For only 2 variations to occur in the 2 places that would make the Descolada most destructive, can that just be the random chance of mutations?
Leaving the genes broken but present is sloppy work if it was deliberate.
But consistent with the mutations we've seen from worlds without a significant ozone layer or other shield. Sloppy.
In just the right places. Or wrong ones, depending.
So as far as we know, some ancient species might have created the recorder virus to make records of every living creature on every planet that uses the DNA system of reproduction, so that when the viruses were collected and read out, a database of life could be assembled.
An obviously mad project, considering that they might eventually collect so much information that there'd be no place to store it or interpret it or index it so you could find and retrieve any of it in the first place.
Well, when it comes to mad projects, we're the team for it.
One thing is certain. Our Descolada virus certainly did not originate on Nest. Rukyak's story seems to be supported by the evidence of the virus genomes.
In that case, we already have all the data we need, don't we?
Oh, biological curiosity invites us to explore how genomes of various Earth biota have changed in the intervening years, but you're right. We've troubled these innocent people enough.
And birds.
When I said people, I was including the birds and the engineers.
Of course. That's the best attitude. Transcript. Ayla and Quara Rivera, as quoted in Conversations in the Box.
Just because Peter and Wang Mu had already decided to heed Dog's advice and remain on Lusitania instead of going back, did not mean that they should not attend the meeting of all the members of the Descalada Project. Ayla allowed Quara to explain that it seemed more than likely that the destructive Descalada virus was a broken copy, coincidentally broken in the most dangerous possible places. It was most likely that most versions that arrived on planets would still be recorder viruses, harmless and scientifically full of potential. Maybe someday we'll meet one of the ships sent out by the recorders to collect and catalog the viruses that worked properly, creating libraries of genomes, said Quara.
And maybe their star went supernova 100 million years ago on the far side of the Milky Way, said Sargent.
So glad you're here, Cincinnatus, said Jane. That seems to me the most likely outcome. Not necessarily the nova, but the high probability that if they survived, they lost interest in the recorder virus project and forgot all about it. After all, the virus they sent out was a harmless data collection device.
Unless it wasn't, said Sargent.
Sprout talked with Rekyak again this morning, said Jane, and he passed along an invitation from the folk to come tonight to a banquet given in our honor.
A trap, said Sargent.
Quite possibly, said Jane. History and mythology are full of such traps, where guests are slaughtered because they trusted in the goodwill and honor of treacherous hosts.
We don't even know these people, said Carlotta.
We have to meet them sometime for that situation to be rectified, said Quara.
But why all of us, said Miro? That seems a strange request.
And it's one that they can't verify. If we arrive with a certain number and say that it's all of us, how can they argue? Asked Quara.
As long as the group we send contains every person they've met on the surface of the planet, said Ender Delphiki. And it won't, said Peter, who could no longer keep silent.
Wang Mu and I will not go back.
Do you think what Dog said to you was a threat? Asked Jane.
Peter said nothing. Wang Mu said nothing.
We can explain, said Ayla, that because Wang Mu is pregnant, you will not transport her through our method anymore.
We need a name for our method, murmured Boss, Ender's son.
I have one already,
said his older sister, called Little Mum by the cousins.
I called it detouring. We never go anywhere directly, right? Jane carries us outside, and then back inside to another location. So no matter where we go, we take a detour.
A shortcut, you mean, said Boss.
It seems to me that the two of you have already had this argument, said Carlotta.
We have, but I won, said Little Mum.
Boss merely rolled his eyes.
Detouring is fine, said Jane. The new names will evolve as long as this mode of travel is being used. But Ella, will you forgive me if, time being so short, I simply cut to the chase? Which of you want to accept this invitation?
Hands went up. As far as Peter could tell, everybody was eager to go except him and Wang Mu. A part of him wanted to be part of the company by raising his hand. But he did not, and Wang Mu did not. They stuck to their resolve.
What armaments will we bring? Asked Sargent.
None, said Ayla. We will be outnumbered.
Thermopylae, said Sargent.
Please recall that the Spartans only held the pass for a few hours,
and then they were all killed, said Ender, who was used to countering any idea of Sargent's with logic and precedent.
There won't be any fighting, said Jane. The instant conflict seems imminent, we will all leave. Those who can do so will transport themselves. I will bring the rest.
You're assuming that you'll detect an imminent attack, said Sargent.
Yes, said Jane. They're still human. If violent desires don't show, fear will, as will deceptive intent. Human beings have been my study all my life.
We have no choice but to trust you, said Ayla. You've never let us down.
There was a momentary silence till Sprout raised his hand.
Ayla, Jane, why aren't there any Formics or Picaninos here at this meeting?
The Queen and the Father Trees barred their children from coming with us to nest, said Jane.
But they've been part of everything else we've done, said Sprout.
Fingers in particular has done as much as any of us. Well, almost anyone.
Which one is Fingers? Asked Little Mum.
The one who looks exactly like a Pecanino, said Ender.
The one who takes care of our computer systems, said Miro. You all know him because he's the only one you ever call to help you deal with a computer problem.
I knew him even before he embraced that nickname, said Ella. A very bright and industrious rapaz.
We have plenty of time to get to know all the Pecaninos who work with us by name, said Miro. They all look completely distinct to me, but I know that for others there's a learning curve.
My intention, said Ella, is to address everyone at the banquet and tell them that we plan to leave Nest for good as of tomorrow, with the assurance that we will not add their world to any database or atlas.
We're really going to leave behind a world with 4 intelligent species, all of Earth origin? Asked Ender.
They aren't specimens, said Ella. We have been told that they want us to leave. If, when I make this announcement, they beg us to stay, then we can hold off for a few days and negotiate a time for us to leave.
Can't we ask the Ravens and Kias for volunteers to come with us? Said Sprout. Say, 12 breeding pairs of each?
I thought you, of all people, said Carlotta, wouldn't want to bring any Kias along.
12 pairs isn't enough. 50 pairs would be a small gene pool, said Quara. But it's a good idea.
If they can find 100 of each species to consent to it.
There's nothing for them here on Lusitania, said Miro.
But our other colony worlds aren't as bare as Lusitania, said Jane. I think there are 8 that are worth trying, as long as the Kias agree to behave.
They'll behave like Kias, said Sprout.
You can't forbid Kias to play, any more than you can forbid humans to talk.
Then we may restrict them to one continent, and warn humans to stay away, said Jane.
There are ways to make it work. Our little colonies are refuges for endangered sentient species. We can add a few more, I think.
The engineers? Asked Sprout.
They are still part of the folk, said Jane. They winter with them underground. But if they ask to come, as permanent colonists and not as tourists, we can find out how the folk feel about it.
Are we done here? Asked Sergeant. I suggest, said Peter, that Sergeant be left behind here with us. Dead silence. Peter rose to his feet. Sergeant's hostile and belligerent attitude, along with his skepticism about all decisions made by the project leaders, makes me fear that he will do something that will provoke an incident with the folk.
I will not, said Sergeant.
And if you do, who will stop you? Asked Peter.
If you plan to take my daughter with you, said Sergeant, I will be there too.
Your daughter will go where she likes, said Jane, as you well know. However, I think that if Cincinnatus wishes to go, we shouldn't leave him behind.
How magnanimous of you, said Sergeant.
We already have his promise to commit no provocations, said Jane.
He's not even part of the project, said Ella.
Only because Jane sequestered all 3 of the giant's children on Nokonoshima on a fool's errand, said Sergeant. But she chose to bring us back, and now we are part of the project, since we know as much about genetics as any of you, having repaired our own twisted genome years ago.
Cincinnatus is right, said Jane. I haven't heard a real reason, other than personal dislike, for me not to transport him.
Anything else?
Sprout raised his hand again. Peter realized for the first time that this hesitant, shy-seeming child was not one to hold back. He seemed timid, but Peter suspected he was as fearless as Thulium.
Thulium isn't here, said Sprout.
That is true, said Jane.
Is she going with us or not? Asked Sprout.
She won't want to be left out.
I know where she is, said Jane.
Where? Asked Sprout.
Where she chose to be, said Jane.
Will we see her on Nest? Asked Sprout.
I expect so, said Jane. As you said, she's not likely to miss this.
The Descolada team stood in a circle in a meadow. A moment before, they had been in the same formation on the lawn outside the compound. A few Pecaninos and Formix were there to see them off, but there were no speeches. A few of them had put canteens on their belts, but nobody had packed food, and nobody carried a weapon. As soon as they arrived on Nest, they heard the crashing of waves against the shore not very far away. There was a shelf of sand that blocked the view of the breakers, but beyond that, they could see ocean stretching on into the distance. "Why here?" asked Sargent. "An underground civilization can't be built this close to the ocean." Jane said nothing. "They must be constantly patching leaks," said Sargent. A few Kias rose up from the grass, and everyone with canteens put their hands on them, but these Kias seemed not to be in a playful mood. One Kia flew up to Sprout's shoulder.
"Where is my royal mother?" asked the Kia.
"Royal son?" asked Sprout. "She's pregnant and didn't want to endanger the baby."
"There's no danger," said Royal Son. "And she was pregnant when she came before."
"Maybe she didn't yet know," said Ayla. "Are you our guide?"
"We are all your guides. We have promised the Raven Council no pranks, no misleading you, no false paths. We will take you to the passage down to the human folk in this part of Nest."
"We're ready," said Sprout.
"Is it far?" asked Sargent.
"Far can mean so many different distances," said Royal Son. "I can't answer, except to say that no human has ever found this distance taxing. But if you need to rest, stop. We'll notice and wait for you."
So they set out, and even the cousins with shorter legs had no trouble keeping up. Sprout walked beside Jane so he could ask questions. "Why is Uncle Sargent with us, and Valentine is not?" "She was afraid that as the oldest among us, she would be regarded as the chief of our party," said Jane. "What's wrong with that?" said Sprout. "It was her preference, as it was Peter's and Wang Mu's." "So now who will they think is our chief?" asked Sprout. "Don't worry, Sprout," said Jane. "It probably won't be you."
"Don't be sure," said Miro. "Sprout was our best diplomat. He earned enough credibility to hear Rukyak's history."
"Oh my," said Jane, but Sprout knew she and Miro were teasing him. Though, what if they weren't? What if he was greeted with great honor?
Sometimes young people could be honored for their deeds. Not as often as they deserved, perhaps, or maybe far more than was good for them, but those who knew what he had done might give him respect.
"Thulium should be here," thought Sprout.
Yes, she fled the Kia's onslaught, but she was right. They were going to be relentless, and why shouldn't she get away?
He had been a fool for staying, until he was no longer a fool.
Thulium had earned her place here. How would she know where they were so she could join them? Jane seemed awfully cavalier about it. The distance was only a little more than a mile. Away from the river's mouth, the ground rose upward to a height at least 30 meters above the sea. Down below the hill, there was still a beach, bright yellow in the daylight. Sprout wondered what it was made of, because it didn't seem like the normal color for silicon dioxide sand. What mattered, though, was not to stray away from the group. He realized that a couple of Kias were trying to herd him away from the brow of the hill and back to the little flock of Hiberas and Delphikis. An awful thought occurred to him. The folk might be perfectly sincere in their invitation to share a meal in their underground habitat, but they might also be planning to kill everyone capable of, what was the new term? Detouring. But they were the least killable people in the world. The folk couldn't be stupid. Rukyak proved that. Different as his body was, he was still part of their society. They all must know how impossible it would be to use any kind of weapon against them. I am limiting myself with words like impossible, thought Sprout. Instead of rejecting the idea that they had any useful weapon, Sprout should try to imagine what kind of weapon they would use. A silent projectile weapon that was undetectable until it struck? For that matter, bullets could travel faster than sound, so they would easily be silent until after they hit the target. Would it be bullets? Where would the folk learn to practice shooting? They did no hunting on the surface, surely. No stray bullets could be allowed to strike a bird or one of the Yachachiruna by accident. Nothing's impossible. And even if an attempt would fail, that didn't mean the folk wouldn't try it. They had nothing to gain by killing anybody, Sprout told himself. The folk's main goal probably wouldn't be murder. They wanted to get the box out of the sky and make sure it never came back. They would erase all knowledge of Nest from the human universe. Except two of the most prominent visitors to the surface were missing, Peter and Wang Mu. And also Thulium, who came only once, but arrived with Sprout. What are their weapons? What is their science? From Rukyak, Sprout had learned that the Yachachiruna were the engineers, the technicians, the builders. If they had any weapons, then as machines they would surely be created by the engineers. Yet Rukyak did not seem to be a treacherous sort of person, a calculating person. He enjoyed telling stories. He seemed to like talking to Sprout. Would he have built weapons designed to kill intrusive visitors like the humans of the Descalata Project? They came to a doorway built into a recessed place in a rocky cliff. They were on high enough ground that they could go down 50 meters without reaching sea level, so Sargent's concern about a leaky roof was probably not a problem. The caverns here would be dry, except maybe leaking groundwater from above them, and if they lived underground, they'd make sure that it wouldn't be leaky and promote the growth of mold. The door opened automatically, or had a key pecked on some hidden control. Maybe some observer had opened it remotely. Inside, there was plenty of room for them all to enter. The walls were smooth, but didn't seem to be made of metal. Or wood. Plastic, then? Not a texture or feel that Sprout was familiar with. He wanted to see if he could scratch the surface, but he had nothing to scratch it with. And anyway, what kind of impression would it make if his first impulse was vandalism? The floor shuddered a little, and Sprout thought, did they think they could make us fall through a huge trap door and die on the stalagmites below? Nonsense. Why was he so afraid? It was just a large elevator, one that could probably raise and lower 100 people at a time. At harvest time, they might bring enough people up to the surface to need to make several trips, but with a 10-person elevator, they couldn't possibly bring a few 100 harvesters up and down in a reasonable time. The elevator went down a long time, but there is no way to gauge how fast they were moving. Had they reached sea level? Deeper? Or only a dozen meters at a very slow pace? The floor shuddered again, and then the back wall rose up, and a vast room opened before them. It did not seem to be a cave at all. The walls were straight and smooth, the ceiling complete and solid, and the floor wasn't stone. The room was cooler than the air on the surface, because that's how it was in caves, but it wasn't bone-chilling. It didn't feel like what Sprout imagined a deep cave would feel like. The air was clean and fresh. Their ventilation system must be superb. Sprout had a sudden thought, and he tugged on Jane's hand. She stopped, and so did Miro. Sprout looked up at her, not sure if he dared to speak aloud. Jane mouthed words and whispered very softly, "Look at me. I can read your words even if you make no sound at all." Sprout spoke accordingly. He didn't even whisper, just mouthed these words.
"Their weapons will be biological," he said. "That is their most advanced science."
Jane squeezed his hand and nodded.
"If you're right," she whispered very softly, "we are probably infected already."
"It's a crazy idea,"
said Sprout, this time with a bit of a whispery sound.
"Your fear is rational," said Miro. "Fearless people are fools, and quite often dead fools."
"I'm monitoring everybody's vital signs," said Jane.
Reassured, Sprout let go of her hand and moved with the others into the room. There were tables arranged in untidy bunches, as if nobody cared whether it was convenient to walk among them. The Kias were no longer with them. They must have stayed on the surface. But they saw humans scattered among the tables. Tall, well-nourished people, so however they handled agriculture here, it must be working well. The introductions were all among adults. The children were not really ignored. Ayla said their names, but the folk directed all their attention toward the adults in their party. That saved Sprout the trouble of trying to figure out polite things to say. Their speech was a fair-sounding Stark, but with an accent that made it hard for Sprout to understand them. It was as if some consonants were said so far back in their throats that the sounds could barely escape. And the vowels, a lot of words seemed to use E and ah and oo as their only vowels, even when other vowels were required. So it was all odd. But at least they hadn't evolved some weird system of tones or something. No doubt the limited vowel set was inherited from Quechua or Aymara, or both. And Stark, being based on English, had an extravagant set of vowels and diphthongs. Without any corrections from contact with the Hundred Worlds, why wouldn't their Stark pronunciations glide in directions more comfortable to them? Ayla, at the front of their party, stopped cold. The others quickly stopped too. Ayla's gaze seemed to be fixed on the dais at the far end of the room. They were almost in the center of the vast cavern, so now was the first time they could have made out the features of the people on the dais. There were several highly elaborate chairs in the middle. Only one of them was occupied, apparently by a child. A princess of some royal family? Miro lifted Sprout up so he could see better. It was Thulium. She had come down here ahead of them. She might even have appeared right here in this room, skipping any journey from the surface. Sprout knew well that you could never put anything past Thulium. If she thought of it, she'd figure out how to do it, and then she'd do it, without asking permission or informing anybody of what she had done. Thulium had appointed herself the first ambassador to the folk, as Peter and Wang Mu had first met the Kias and Ravens, and Sprout himself had first met a Yachachi. But knowing Thulium, Sprout feared that she had said too much or too little, or had chosen words that would make all the wrong impressions, and she hadn't been at the meeting where the plan of announcing the complete departure of all off-worlders was explained. Thulium had no idea of the plan, and yet she had preempted it with whatever she decided was the right thing to say. Sprout felt a flash of anger at her. How dare she? And then his normal calm returned to him. They had treated her well enough. She was dressed in some fine clothing of a style and fabric that Sprout didn't recognize. It certainly wasn't the clothing Thulium would have arrived in, unless it was a Japanese costume. Yes, that's what it was. She went to visit her mother on Nokonoshima, Sprout realized. Of course she did. Uncle Sergeant couldn't persuade his wife to come with him, but Thulium would never allow that to keep her from meeting her mother. and Eiri would have given her some fine clothing to wear on her return trip. Did Thulium go directly from Nokonoshima to here? Was she that skilled now that she could go to a place where she had never been and pass through solid rock to reach a subterranean cavern? Eventually, he'd find out what she did. She would tell him. He would be proud of her for her accuracy and audacity. He would be resentful of her for having such contempt for the rest of the group. But he would only show the pride in her, the admiration he felt for her, because he was quite sure that others would express their anger at this stunt. He would not need to be part of that chorus. A man of the folk, wearing an elaborate headdress, stood beside Thulium's chair and spoke. His voice was amplified, and every word was clear. There wasn't any reverberation.
"Our dear friend Thulium has brought her friends to us as she promised she would. Thulium, please tell us all their names."
Thulium stayed in the chair, and her voice, too, was amplified clearly. She named each of them in turn, and to Sprout's surprise, a spotlight shone on each of them, as if the light operators already knew who was who. Maybe they did.
"Come join me at the high table," said Thulium. "All things delicious and healthful await you here."
They must have given her that script. She would have scorned such flowery and over-formal verbiage, unless she was trying to be diplomatic. Wouldn't that be nice, if Thulium had learned to be tactful? The whole party walked toward the front and stood where various men and women directed them. Everyone had a chair, though nobody but Thulium had one of the finely decorated thrones. Except that as soon as Sprout got on the dais, he slipped behind the thrones and stood directly behind Thulium's seat. He gave her no sign that he was there. He figured he was small enough that nobody out on the main floor of the place would notice him. Any attempt to communicate with Thulium would make him visible and obvious to the audience. But then curiosity got the better of him. He stepped between two thrones and looked right at Thulium. She didn't turn her face to look at him at all. Maybe her peripheral vision didn't see him. They had her face thickly caked with makeup that looked chalky, far too white. Her features had been painted over the white so that it seemed a miracle that Sprout had recognized her. Then he looked more closely. There was an unevenness to the white substance, or maybe it had been applied over seriously bumpy skin. But Thulium didn't have any bumps on her skin. She had a very clear complexion. Instead of dismissing his worried thought, Sprout immediately took action to see what was really happening with her skin. He flashed out his hand and with his fingernails scraped away the layer of white on her cheek. The white stuff flaked and fell off, and underneath it, Sprout could see what looked like dozens of small blisters. His fingernails had opened some of them, and a clear fluid had burst out of them. Was this just an allergic reaction to the white face paint? Or was the white face paint there to conceal the pustules? Sprout called out, "Jane!" as he turned Thulium's face so the bare place on her cheek faced Jane. A few people were moving to try to intercept Jane, but that was useless, and Sprout noticed that others, including the ones who seemed to be the highest officials, were cheerful enough about Sprout's discovery, as if they had already won a war that wasn't supposed to start, said Jane to Sprout. "Take her," said Jane to Thulium. Then, more loudly, she reached out her arms to all of the party. "To Cubae," she called. "Now!" In a moment, Everyone who had gone up onto the dais was packed into Q-Bay, not just the isolation chamber, but the offices just outside it as well. Silence, Jane commanded. Ayla, roll call. In a moment, Ayla answered, All here. Quara spoke up. I'll send a message to all the staff. Don't come inside. This whole building is now quarantined. Good, said Ayla. Sprout saw that Jane was standing directly in front of Thulium. Fearing that the onslaught would be terrible, Sprout immediately went to Thulium and held her hand. But Jane was not rebuking her.
How many hours were you there, my love? Asked Jane. Yesterday afternoon, murmured Thulium.
Sprout was relieved that she could answer at all. She looked weak and frightened.
When did the pustules appear? Asked Jane. This morning when I woke up. They sting badly when they break.
Other symptoms, said Jane. Thulium told her of a blinding headache, sparks dancing like comets across her vision, congestion that made her short of breath, and violent diarrhea since she got up.
Everyone was very kind, said Thulium. They give you a fatal disease, said Jane, against which all of them have been inoculated, and then treat you kindly as you die.
Will she die? Asked Sprout.
It's what I deserve, said Thulium.
Then she gasped for air.
Oxygen, said Jane, and at once Ayla had an oxygen mask over Thulium's face.
Should we intubate you? Asked Jane, so you can breathe?
Thulium pulled her face away from the mask. Not yet, she said.
Then she pushed her face back into the mask.
I don't know how long we might have stayed, said Jane, if we hadn't had Thulium there early to show us the symptoms of the folk's biological weapon.
Do you recognize the disease? Muro asked Ayla.
No, said Ayla, but we'll be looking at her blood and tissues and find ways to treat the symptoms, at least, and the underlying disease as soon as possible. Whatever is happening to Thulium will happen to the rest of us in 12 hours.
Blood and tissue samples were taken and placed in the various microscopes. Team members knew how to read the samples and quickly identified the two microorganisms that were savaging Thulium's body. One of them attacked the red blood cells. The other was encasing the nerve cells in her limbs and face.
Progressing inward, said Quara, who was administering the internal examination. But so far, nothing shows up in her internal organs. So maybe we still have time, said Jane. Thulium, said Ayla, we're going to have to experiment on you. We'll try every treatment that seems to have a reasonable chance, and we'll be attacking these little beasts outside your body to see what kills them. But you're our test case.
Thulium nodded.
Don't let it escape from this building,
she whispered. We've already got negative pressure everywhere, said Miro. Everything moved so quickly that Sprout couldn't keep track of who was doing what. But while everyone else was busy at various tasks, Sprout found that Uncle Sergeant sat beside Thulium's bed, holding her hand. Everyone spoke their findings aloud, and Sprout had no problem understanding everything that they learned, which mostly consisted of treatments that would not work. Every now and then, Thulium herself made a suggestion. Sometimes Ayla replied by saying, Do it, to one of the others. Sometimes Ayla replied to Thulium, Already tried it. Dead end. Through it all, Sprout did nothing useful. With Thulium's father holding her hand, even that job was unavailable to him. But he had never worked on pathology, and now was not a good time for him to get someone to train him. So he leaned against a far wall and tried to tell if his own symptoms were appearing yet.
Whatever is happening to Thulium will happen to all of us. Find a cure,
Please.
Did the Ravens and Kias know the plan? The engineers? Were they complicit, or were they deceived as the Lusitanian party had been? This could not have been known to Dog the Raven, or Royal Sun, or Phoenix, or Rukyak. But Rukyak might know the principles underlying this disease. It was surely part of engineer science. If they could only talk to him, they might make faster progress toward a cure. But this was war. Just because you liked someone before the war started didn't mean he was still your friend now that hostilities had begun. If Sprout went to Nest now, no one would lead him to Rukyak. The people of Nest might well assume that, having been betrayed himself, Sprout would readily betray anyone who helped him. Sprout was as helpless as he felt. He wondered if the heat he felt in his face was rage or fear or the first onset of the fever.
Thulium, please live. You're the best of us. If all the rest of us are saved but you die, then the people of Nest would have scored a terrible blow. If Thulium dies, thought Sprout, I'm going to make sure that every star map and atlas in the 100 worlds shows the exact location of Nest and what the underground people of Nest did under pretense of hospitality.